This is Joe Nunez,
Avery Pascal,
Mauricio von Hasselt,
and Paul McKenna.
And this is the Film Tools Podcast. Our guest this week, Mauricio, is a special effects graphic. I don't know. How would you explain it?
You know what? My actual entire family has the same problem, so don't worry about it.
See, before you said that, I know of him as a cinematographer. Everything I've seen has been more camera-related than it is VFX. So when I asked you, and Avery told me, oh, he does great VFX, it's like, uh-oh.
So we opened that box up.
Yeah. Well, I think the first time we met Mauricio, we were at the Phil Holland event we had on last week. It was great. Yeah. At Film Tools for the Geminis. And you were showing us some fantastic work that you were doing. It was practical, but also miniature. It was just a very interesting project. I think there was some VFX that was mixed into the project.
Oh, you know what? Thank you for using the word, exciting, because I have some other adjectives that are not necessarily that positive. But it's a crazy thing because, you know, as much as, you know, pixels are obviously part of the tool set nowadays, and I obviously have a great time enjoying them, it's overused, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of the things that have gotten us really excited about lately is just, you know, trying to circumvent the necessity of using pixels for everything. So
You say pixels, what do you mean by pixels?
Visual effects, sure. Digital work, where, you know, you elaborate basically pretty much assets on the computer instead of actually just, you know,
doing it in real
yourself. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so that's interesting. I'm newer to the industry in general. Mm-hmm. And I've had a number of conversations with people who are doing a lot of work with miniatures right now. Is that sort of an uptick within the industry that you've noticed as well? Or it seems like something that I've seen a number of times and have conversations with people who have been talking about, you know, using miniatures.
I think it generally reflects the times that we're living in, where, you know, the audience might be a little bit too fed up with the digital flavor. Because, I mean, any kind of visual effects that you do is going to have to run through some form of software that it's already, you know, pretty much used by industry standards. So the look that is going to be provided is it's kind of overseen now.
Yeah.
You kind of see in every film the results of the standard visual effects pipeline.
Yeah.
So I guess that filmmakers are also realizing that and thinking that there has to be another way of things, to make things, look different. So.
Absolutely. So I guess we should take a step back, and we'd love to hear a little bit about you and who you are and sort of your path within the industry and how, you know, you got to where you are now and some of your goals of the future. So I guess start with, who are you and where'd you come from and all that kind of stuff.
Oh my God, that's a good one. I'll try to.
His path is a zigzag.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's an ever-evolving question. When you look back and you say, well, where did I come from? I mean, that could be relative to where you are, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Where's the point of origin and the point of no return? So. I guess my first goal was I really wanted to be a fighter pilot. That was my aim and goal. It's crazy, right? So, Academy, all the things, and they told me that my eyesight was not really going to cut me a space in the office, you know? So I was most probably going to end up ground crewing my way through it. So that didn't sound really exciting. I mean, the age is going to show, and you can realize that you'll probably realize that Tom Cruise was inspiration for all that sort of madness. So,
Top Gun.
Yeah. But, you know, after that, I was, I darted back to my, to my other real passion, which was film. It's just that, for some crazy reason, when I was a kid, we were living in Mexico City. My father was back and forth on diplomatic things. And my grandfather actually had access to the studios over there, and they were shooting David Lynch's Dune in '82. Yeah, it's crazy. So, he was aware that I was pretty much a fan of all these crazy starships and madness. So he called me over and he said, like, hey, you know what? You might want to take a look at this. So he took me there, and I was able to see, actually, speaking of miniatures, all the craziness that was going on with this wonderful, honestly, Spanish artists who were making all the miniatures for the, for those initial scenes, especially of that film. And I got to say that blew me away.
Interesting.
So was Dune shot at the Imperial Sand Dunes?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Where is that?
It's Southern California, deep south. Near Mexicali, maybe?
Yeah, it's actually the Sonoran Desert, if I'm understanding properly. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of, very close by locales where those things were shot. You remember that scene in the Emperor's Palace at the very start of the film? It's a crazy thing. That thing was shot in Churubusco. and in Mexico City. So, you know, just seeing that craziness was exciting enough. The first time that I saw a blue screen ever. So, like, oh, what interesting. Is that?
So you grew up in Mexico. Are you originally from Mexico, or is it?
No, actually, it's a crazy mix, because I was originally born in Spain, but we left when I was, pretty young. And then we did some European things and ended up in Mexico City for a while. Okay. So that's where I kind of, had some part of my childhood. So it definitely struck a chord in these visual forms.
So when did the filmmaking bug bite you? Like, at what point, as you're growing up, did you realize you were interested in making films or being part of that whole scene?
Well, I have to admit that, obviously these childhood experiences were partly responsible, at least. The other thing was definitely just a very visually motivated kind of upbringing. I mean, there was a lot of, there was no criteria for how young you could be to watch any kind of film whatsoever. Yeah. So, my parents really pushed a lot of stuff into our way early on. And I mean, I remember, questioning my father and mother what they had just went seen, to the theater the previous night. And they had gone to see Mad Max, right? The Road Warrior. And I was like, oh my God, please tell me about it. Because that little thing in the newspaper, ages go, but newspapers would carry this tiny little image of, the kind of film to promote it, right? So we saw that, me and my brother saw it. I'm like, oh my God, this looks so exciting. And then we would question them about what was it. Then they would go at length and detail about what they had seen. And, as soon as they were able to get our, whatever form of like beta or VHS tape on their hands, they would push it our way, right?
Love that.
I think this is the first time on the podcast we've heard beta tape.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Or Betamax, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. What a treat, right?
Yeah. Wild.
I miss those. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So you had some exposure to film sets or to the idea of what a film set is and the blue screen and Dune and all that kind of stuff down in Mexico. And so at what point did you decide that you needed to pick up the camera or that you needed to be involved personally in that creative process?
Well, I guess I'm going to go back to my, foiled attempt of earning my wings. I guess it was something that definitely attracted me for sure, but it's also part of the inspiration obviously comes from a very visual standpoint. I mean, obviously you have this amount of reference about what you see and what you perceive the world to be as through your visual experiences, even your movie experiences. And as much as that, let's say emboldened me to try the Air Force route, I guess it also provided me a lot of flavors that I really enjoyed, even if I would have never flown it yet, of course. But obviously I kind of felt attracted to the way that whole idea was inspired on me. It was put in front of me, I guess. So looking back into what brought the inspiration of that sort of inspiration in the first place, well, obviously it was a film. And then how did they make that film? I mean, were they able to capture those shots and whatever not? Connect with the fact that, I had centrally resonated with the industry, I guess, or with the process for long. That was pretty, pretty easy to leap from, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so did you ever have that experience where, someone handed you the camera or, someone gave you access to that gear and you were like, okay, I need to try this creative process for myself. I need to like actually put whatever is in my own mind onto film.
Well, it's actually a funny thing because my first experiences, let's say in the craziness of the actual process, I guess, I was, casted for a couple of like commercials as a kid, as a really young kid for, shoe shine commercials. It was ridiculous. So, I mean, I really enjoyed watching how everything kind of convoluted around this single objective. And that was quite enjoyable. But I have to admit that obviously the one thing that attracted me the most was that majestic object in front of us, doing these crazy whirling and sounds. And, I definitely kind of gravitated towards, the camera as an embodiment of the actual, as a pivotal piece of the process, I would say.
Yeah.
And and there was a lot of also, I guess, photographic taste in the family. So kind of it was easy to resonate to that too. Yeah.
Love that. And so at what point in your career did the visual VFX sort of make its way as a part of your identity and where did that sort of start for you?
That's an interesting one. Okay, so years go by, and eventually opened a little pose boutique in Mexico, actually. You know, after working there for a while, I was able to set up my own thing. And one of my clients eventually landed a very large contract for a presidential campaign from one of the candidates over there. So he, approached me and he was like, hey, you know what? I kind of like your setup. Would you mind if I rent it for a month? I was like, that doesn't sound terrible. Like, yeah, sure. Go for it. You know, go and play. So, things were obviously working out. And then he, at some point he asked me like, hey, you know what? I really, really like this. How much do you want for it? Right. I was like, what? Seriously? So, that became kind of a point where I was able to kind of regroup and realize where I was standing. So hold that thought for a second. And then just a few months prior, my ex-wife, actually, she was an executive at PepsiCo.
Okay.
So they made, when the whole madness with the Matrix came out, they made an ad for these Doritos, which had some volume to them, Doritos 3D. I don't even know. You remember those?
I don't remember those.
They were
at all,
like kind of crazy shaped Doritos.
Like puffy Doritos?
Yeah, exactly. Like puffy Doritos. That's a great, actually, they should be called that. So these puffitos. They invested so much money in making an ad because they were the rage in Asia. So they decided to make an ad based on the Matrix. And, obviously high end commercial. And, she was aware that, obviously my girlfriend at that time was pretty much aware that I like this stuff. So she was like, hey, you know what? We're going to shoot this madness in Vancouver. So you want to join us? I mean, you can come as part of the, client. I was like, that's not bad. So I joined them. And funny enough, I struck a really good chord with the director of the commercial.
Okay.
An Argentinian, by the way, who basically, we struck a chord. So he allowed me to pretty much just leave the client's little, palace and just, hang around the crew. So, I really got to realize how much further the whole envelope with visual effects had come at that point. Because, at that time, the amount of instruction, let's say, or official instruction or information even available about visual effects was minimal. Obviously, we're talking pre-YouTube times, pre-kind of like internet explosion of, let's say, tutorials or whatever. Not, I mean, internet at that time, but at that point was even in its infancy. So it was more about basically just either you were part of it and knew how basically to do those things by practice, or you pretty much had no idea. So that really blew my mind. I was pretty impressed. And we hung around so well that he actually allowed me to do the animatic for that commercial when we were back after the shoot. So, obviously, I did my best to pull it off graciously and whatever not. So, at the end of it, he presented it. The client loved it. I swear that my, girlfriend at that time didn't have to do anything with that decision. It was completely objective. So they loved it. And I was obviously expecting him to give me the full-on commercial, right? So, he approached me very gently. He said, no, sorry, Mao. No, you're not getting it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though. I'm going to leave you the demo reel of the actual company who's going to get it. I'm like, really? Thank you. So he left me the reel for Rainmaker Studios up in Vancouver, which was fairly competent visual effects shop over there. So yeah, I watched the reel and I realized that I didn't have a chance in the world. You're like, you know what? He probably made the right choice. So he definitely did, actually. So long story short is like, when I get this opportunity to sell my studio, I kind of saw back into it and I was like, you know what? I'm actually just staying behind because I really haven't been able to embrace this visual effects, craziness. Instead of just going full on, as obviously some people are, I'm pressing key by key on the keyboard to kind of figure out what every function in the software does, right? So it gets you somewhere, but it definitely doesn't get you fast enough to keep up with the curve of the industry. So I was like, no, screw that. So since I was able to sell it, I was like, I'll use all this to kind of resettle over in Vancouver and, get more education.
Really?
Yeah, and kind of did another major over there at BFS, at Vancouver Film School, specializing in visual effects and animation.
Wow.
How much time did that take?
Well, I stayed over there for 2 years. So, nice. Yeah, that was kind of like, I really wanted to get a hold of it. So, yeah.
What was the software that you learned when you were in Vancouver?
Funny enough, it was Softimage. Ah. Softimage XSI, actually. Softimage, and because Softimage had a great reputation at the start of things, Because you know it had been used in Jurassic Park, so oh my god, it's powerful and crazy nuts. But Maya at that time was already picking up rapidly on its, you know, I don't know why, but everybody used to love the interface, and it became a standard really fast. I mean, it evolved from a previous software that was somewhat already kind of popular in the industry. But it's crazy just how rapidly Maya took over. And so we were kind of disappointed at that time. Well, when I first got to, you know, to school, the first day, it's a great question. Because the first thing that pops up is like, okay, we're going to learn Softimage XSA. I'm like, what? Yeah. This is madness. Give me my money back, you know? Maya is the thing. And then I rapidly realized that it's never, ever about the software. It's about just understanding what you're doing with it. Of the course. Rest are just buttons in different menus. As long as you get it. Yeah. It really can, you know, be called, you know, milkshake, 3D, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's a recurring theme on the podcast too, I think. It's not the gear, right?
Yeah.
You always hear Avery say it.
Yeah.
It's not the gear. It's about your vision and then just using the tools to carry it out. So
absolutely. I mean, and we all have preferences. I get it. You know, obviously you feel more comfortable with some things or than others. But I say that there is a bar that has to be met by gear or software or whatever not. A bar has to be met in order for the capacity to do whatever the creative is intending to do. That has to be met. But once that is met, pretty much is whatever you prefer, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. If you do it long enough, they tell you, especially in school, but just in work, don't fall in love with the gear. Fall in love with the process.
Completely.
Because the process won't change.
Yeah.
The gear will.
Mm-hmm.
Every 5 years, new stuff to learn, sometimes faster.
That's so true.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about where you're at now. So now you're out here in Burbank, right?
Yes. Sorry, in Los Angeles.
Yeah. In the city.
Yeah.
Greater Los Angeles.
The belly of industry. The beast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what brought you here?
Oh.
And what kind of projects that you're allowed to speak of, you know, have you been working on that are exciting and all that good stuff?
Well, I mean, what brought me here is precisely because after school, I just basically, you leave school with a bag full of dreams and a demo reel, right? So I basically shipped my demo reel everywhere. I mean, you still used to send tapes and DVDs back then. So basically I emailed it everywhere and I mailed it everywhere, sorry. And then I got a response from a studio here in Los Angeles and like, hey, you want to join us? I'm like, well, okay, sure, it doesn't sound bad. So that's why, you know, I moved pretty much right after school for, you know, over here. And then it's funny because the world tour started pretty fast. I mean, I moved at the moment where, you know, we used to have so many visual effects studios, major ones here in Los Angeles, you know, with hundreds of artists each. It was great. It was you know, an utopia. And then suddenly they realize the world is actually very competitive and I'm pretty good at it.
Here comes India.
Exactly. So, yes. So, it all started in London, and then from London, you know, like, what? London? Yeah, so from London, it was like, hey, you mind, you know, checking those guys in India? You know, they kind of, they could use some help and some training. And then I lived in Mumbai for years, you know.
Really?
Wow, it's crazy. You've traveled the world pursuing this dream, right?
Or the dream pursuing me. I mean, whatever you want to call it. I don't know which, you know, who does who. It's pretty crazy how it's all over the place. That even took me back to Vancouver for a while. I mean, Mexico as well. I mean, there's so many. I mean, the visual effects world is totally globalized nowadays, for better or for worse. I have bittersweet, you know, views about it.
Well, it sounds like there's been this roller coaster ride. You had your initial foray, and you had an opportunity to sell, and then to start over as a student to learn the software, right? Or to learn the process in Vancouver. And then now you're teaching people? Is that why you're traveling?
Well, I used to you know, train a lot of artists. I mean, that was kind of my role for a very long time at a major studio. So that brought so many satisfactions. And that brought also so much understanding of, you know, what you're dealing with in terms of the big beasts of the actual industry, you know, of the big projects in the industry.
Well, tell me about a little bit about, you know, how similar or how different is the filmmaking cultures in all these different countries, all these different places around the globe. What's that experience like?
Well, I love this question. I mean, I think that one of the things that I have noticed the most is how how in every film market, there's always that divide between the production and the post-production side. It's crazy how that keeps repeating itself. This kind of, even I would say, disdain from the film crews in terms of what's going to happen afterwards in post.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, they seem to talk so little in between them. And that, to me, that is just one of the biggest hindrances in the process in the industry even.
So why do you think that, why is it that there's that disconnect between those two super important, I mean, they have to work hand in hand, but there seems to be some sort of wall there. Why do you think that is? How did that sort of develop?
I mean, I want to say that because of the film culture is so naturally proud of its, you know, heritage and, you know, pedigree. That it, in a lot of regards, I think any filmmaker, any on-set filmmaker or part of member of the filmmaking process is so proud about just being able to stand in there that really considers himself or herself the primal component of the entire filmmaking envelope. It's also pretty much ingrained in basically pretty much the discourse in universities and places. I mean, it's just... we all know how difficult it is for you to get there, that I guess it makes sense that you become this too proud of yourself kind of personality, which I get it. You should be proud about your work. But at the same time, you have to realize that you have always got to remember that you're a cog within the machine. And the machine is composed by so many that, you know, you have to keep yourself objective about it. And I think that it comes a little bit from there, and it also comes from the fact that the artist on the post side or the visual effects side, I think that it has a little bit of a different profile that doesn't necessarily connect 100% with the more pragmatic, immediate reaction kind of on the moment kind of times that, you know, the production side requires. I think it's a little bit of a different psyche between those two kind of artists. In a way, it makes sense because the post-production guy will have more comfort, I guess, to take their decisions. And silly, crazy, shouldn't be that way because the times are so constrained now in order to push everything done and whatever not. So it's a lot of stress in the visual effects post-production side. But anyways, there is a little bit of more of a comfort of being able to sit there and make the decisions that you want to make. So
yeah.
Also, when you start a movie, there's a fresh budget.
Yeah.
You make that budget go away, and all of a sudden it's time to do post and mixing and music, and you don't have the money that was intended for them has been spent long ago in a place far away with lots of extras eating sushi.
Oh, so
the sushi's gone in post.
Yeah, there's no catering that.
It's Little Caesar's pizza.
Yeah, when you get lucky, and tons of Red Bull, that's for sure. So. Yeah, so I think it's so less glamorous, so less, there's so little mystique, I guess.
Also, if you go into an editing suite, no matter where you are in the world, or even a mixing suite for audio, it's the same equipment everywhere you go. There's no difference.
True.
So there may be preferences on the pre-production side and on the production side, but the post is all the same. Everybody's on an Avid. Or a Premiere, or a Final Cut. So,
and definitely a Pro Tools, you know, station.
And always Pro Tools.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely more.
But you could be in Tokyo, you could be in Mumbai.
For sure.
And you open your eyes, and that same place is a copy of someplace in Los Angeles.
That is so true. Even the model, I guess, the look of, of an editing suite.
Yeah.
Or what used to be those beautiful flame suites back in the day.
Yes.
I mean, there was kind of like an understanding of what the setup should be like, you know, in order to make things proper. So,
Once you walk into that room, it doesn't matter what country you're in.
Oh, absolutely.
You're in your editing suite.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of setups, one of the most interesting things that I see when I watch some of the behind-the-scenes footage is the setups that they do for the visual effect artists, where they combine the practical effects, right? So somebody's knocking over boxes or doing whatever. Like I've seen the Transformers clip, and then the guy comes back in and he puts a robot there instead of whatever, right? So have you been on both sides of that? Have you been on the side of you're actually capturing it on camera and then working on it on the post side of things? And if so, tell me a little bit about that, because I find it so interesting. It's like I'm looking at the movie and I can't tell where the, you know, practical effects are happening, or if it's actually
pre-vis versus post-vis.
Yeah,
of course.
So how does that play out?
I'm so happy that you haven't noticed, because that means that, you know, whoever's behind her has earned her credit. Yeah. So, I mean, it's actually, to me, the most exciting space to be at, when you're able to use your mind's eye on set in order to realize what's going to be definitely better to include on the visual effects side later. So if you're able to make those decisions, I mean, personally, I think that there is a lot of added value to the professional who's able to understand where does the line is, you know, where's the line drawn in order to make the most economically savvy decisions where to include pixels or not. So, I mean, I also love the fact that there are so many little things that you can do on set, which are going to be massively more efficient to do at the moment, at the time, with something with extremely cheap resources. Mm. Than to wait for it to be fixed in post.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is probably one of my worst, most hated phrases. Like, you should never fix in post.
That's... How much do you use storyboarding in this?
Oh, crazy. I'm actually a paladin for pre-production. Okay. I really believe pre-production is key of the entire process. You want to make a proper film or a proper project or whatever not, pre-produce. I would say spend 70% of your time in pre-production, 10-15% in production, and actually 10-15 or 15-20 in post-production. It should go that way. I mean, the production moment in all its glory and excitement should be the most compact, most efficient, most predictable of all of them. You should pretty much just execute a drawn-out plan that you spend months and length making in pre-production. That's what I firmly believe in. I mean, obviously, we would all love to spend on set, you know, years in, you know, I don't know, shooting Lawrence of Arabia 4, but, you know, we shouldn't. We really should just become super efficient, you know, filmmakers. Yeah. Or shooters, should I
say. Yeah.
Well, tell me, you know, part of my question,
a couple
questions back was, what is it that's, you know, you're working on right now that's super excited that you can exciting that you can share with us?
Okay. Right now, you know, at finally, I guess, you know, the moment came for me to say, like, okay, let's actually produce a film. So, you know, a year and a half, almost 2 years, you know, a friend and I just got together and decided to share a moment of truth between, of honesty between us, and say, like, okay, I want to make a film. Really? I do too. We were actually rendering our lives away a very late evening. And we're like, you know, this is crazy. We're spending our, you know, better years watching renders go for a film that I really don't want to even watch. So I should make one. It's like, yeah, we should make one too. Really? What do you want to make? Sci-fi? No way. Me too. So we met, you know, late that night at Stout Burgers, which I highly recommend. So, and while having a beer, you know, he shared his story. I shared mine. And I was like, you know what? Well, we're going to make yours. He's like, what? Seriously? I'm like, yep. He's like, well, why mine? Like, very simple, buddy. Yours costs $5. Mine costs $20.
Yeah.
So, wow. You know, we got to start somewhere. I mean, you really have to be as passionate as you are about your own stories. You have to be realistic in terms of how are you going to make it happen. So, so that basically triggered a decision to embark in this, you know, producer's role, I guess, which I have found extremely exciting, by the way, because there's always that conflict, right? Like, oh, I want to be a filmmaker, right? Should I direct? Should I produce? Should I shoot? You know what? There's so much excitement on every single one of the positions that I don't even know at this stage in my life which one I enjoy the most.
Really?
Oh, it's crazy how you know, enjoyable every one of those are. So we started basically doing this, and it all started pretty much on the idea of just shooting a short that we would be super happy to display in festivals or whatever not, and gather momentum, blah blah blah. So it all started there. We pretty much developed all the visuals, all the pretty much pre-production work for it. So at that point, we decided to embark on shooting, actually. It took us, I want to say, 3 months. Yeah, 3 to 4 months of pre-production just to get all the entire look and feel of what we were going to do. And then we started basically pretty much photography. In Iceland, because Iceland was pretty much, it's a sci-fi piece, and we required this devastated planet look, And oh my God, Iceland.
That's the best place to go, yeah.
It's crazy, right? It's like, where's the asteroid, man? It's just crazy how, you know, how barren the place is. And at the same time, you turn the other way, 90 degrees, and there's this beautiful waterfall, greenery all around, you know, sheep making love. I mean, it's crazy. it's just ridiculous how contrasted it is in terms of its you know, chromatics. It's a pretty exciting place. And it all came precisely because, you know, we were at this junction where we were watching the concept art, and we recorded this look, as I was saying, this wasteland. And like, well, you know what? I mean, we went check out the deserts here, Utah, whatever not. And to me, it always felt a little bit too overchromatic, a little bit too lively. And the skies had no clouds whatsoever, so it always looked, you know, I guess, too bland. And it's also over, you know, not that Iceland is not being used in everything nowadays, but, you know, in a way, it's still a little bit more exotic, I guess. Mm. So when, you know, when we came back from those scouting grounds around here, I was like, you know what, I think this is going to have to be green screen. And part of our vision since the very first moment, since the very first decisions, was no, we're going to limit the pixels as much as we can. We're going to minimize the visual effects component to its bare essentials so that we use only visual effects to shine, never to fix, you see? Here's just a parenthesis, I guess. I firmly believe that you should capture 90% of your frame in camera, if possible, obviously 100, but let's say that you need some amount, there's some components of it that you really just cannot make up yourself. Okay, try to get 90% there. So then when you go into visual effects land, you can rise that frame to 150% of what it could be, you know? Mm-hmm. You really use the time in post, in visual effects, to make that thing extraordinary beyond, you know, whatever you, you know, your starting point was. Instead of starting at a, let's say, 60 or 50% of a frame, where you're going to take your visual effects frame and just make it workable. Just make it, you know, okay, it works, but it doesn't shine. You know, there's so much you can do in visual effects to make it unbelievably cool. So yeah, it's time better invested that way. Yeah,
well, I think that's good. Probably, sorry to interrupt, Paul, but I think that's probably some of the footage you shared with us a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
And that looks stunning.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you
so
very much.
I'll let Paul ask his question, then I'll follow up on...
Oh, it was more of a statement that when you leave that much to fix in post, that's not creative time. That's the time you use to take care of problems.
Yeah.
You only get so much time. So if you can have that as your creative time and do that 10% he's talking about, as opposed to the 50% of fixing the root problems,
absolutely,
it's so much more creative to do it that way.
I agree. Yeah. It's so much more enjoyable because then, you know, visual effects becomes a creative task.
As opposed to just fixing.
Correct, Amanda. Then, you know, one of the other decisions that we came back from Iceland all happy and excited about our, you know, gear or our footage and whatever not. And then we decided to actually make a set for, you know, part of the thing. And we built pretty much this space station room in my garage. So, and it was enjoyable. I discovered my newfound carpentry abilities that I had never, ever tried before.
Yeah.
I mean, thanks God, YouTube, I was able to see how you basically saw how you make a circular window. I was like, hey, I have no idea. So, yeah, I mean, we didn't lose any fingers in the process and we had tons of fun. Took us another 2 months of, you know, bob time, but but it was great. I mean, at the very end of time, we just finished it and it looked fantastic. We got the actor. We imported an actor from the Netherlands.
Really?
He lived with us for a month. It was phenomenal.
Nice.
Like, you know, every day we would work for the entire day at the studio. Then, you know, we finish at the studio, we run to my place, like, okay, knock on the door, Leon, wake up, you know, come into my garage, let's shoot for the night, and, you know, go back to bed, and, you know, we go back to work. Crazy times, but so much fun. So much fun. And yeah, the results, I mean, we're extremely satisfied with the results, because they really adhered to our original vision, you know, we didn't have to make any kind of compromises to it, and that was exciting. So, after capturing all of that material and actually putting all together, we pretty much, well, I just came across something called the American Film Market, which these are the kind of things that you're oblivious to in the post side. You never know what happens, how these things make money or whatever or not. It's crazy. So I came across that and I realized that, like, hey, you know what? Actually, we should go there. You know, we should just see what it's like, you know? So we put together a proof of concept pretty much. And we decided to label this initially short film project as a feature film potential, project, essentially, a product. So yeah, we put it together. We went to the market. We were only able to afford the one day. And by the way, to anyone, I have to say this, please, guys, because we asked around crazy about, like, oh, so how does it go? What should we do? Whatever not. We got so many different variations on how to approach this thing that most of them told us, you know what, do you have a film? I was like, no. Then why do you go there? You shouldn't go there. You go there to sell films. If you don't have a film, what are you going to sell? Hmm. Like, no, well, I have a proof of concept. Yeah, you're wasting your money. Not true. Not absolutely true. I mean, you go there and it's pretty much, I was expecting an expo kind of layout. No, it's a hotel where basically pretty much every distributor, every distribution company gets a room, which is locked. And you got to make, pretty much appointments prior in order to get to the whatever room at whatever time. Crazy setup. Anyways, that's part of another genuinely entertaining story. But, we made ourselves there and we knocked on doors and we pushed some elbows and we eventually landed a few distribution interests.
Really?
It was crazy. Yeah. We were ecstatic. I mean, I still remember how much I drank that night. It's phenomenal. So that's when we realized, okay, we have a feature film project. So this is pretty much about, let's say, a year ago. And from that time, we pretty much have been developing now the full feature, structure out of it, which is sounds easy, but it's a totally different animal. Totally, totally different animal. I mean, we're in a happy place because we have a lot of the information is already being fed through the process of making the short film. Obviously, it carries a lot of similar flavors. Obviously, there's a lot of pre-production precisely that has already been executed by doing the short form project, let's say. So that has really helped out. So among the other things that we decided to do was include miniatures, and that's where we saw each other, because yes. It sounds simple, but it's really I had never done miniatures in my life before, and it was one of those decisions that I will always regret and congratulate myself on taking every single day that I see that madness. It's so much work, but so much enjoyable, beautiful work. There are so many details that you have to consider that I had never had the opportunity of being myself in a project where I had to consider those. So, the smallest details matter the most when you're talking about miniature work.
So for the miniature, if I remember correctly, it's a somewhat recreation of the landscape of Iceland. Is that
correct.
Sort of?
That's so correct.
What's the benefit of doing a miniature? Is it because of the drain on time and effort to get out to the actual set, or is it actually trying to control the environment? Is that really what the main draw is? Is it controlling the environment?
I think you nailed it. Yeah. Totally. You get that amount of control of stage work that you wouldn't be able to get on location.
Sure.
We get it. The kind of weather patterns that we are interested on, the kind of, situations that we're interested on, we don't having to be there and, pray to the gods of, nor the gods to, give us the weather we want. So, yes, exactly. It's a matter of control, repetition, being able to just really extract whatever flavors you're interested in. And it's also a time, very economic and economically effective decision as
sure.
well. It's incredible how much money we saved on that.
And so for that specific work, how do you... Are you mixing really your VFX background with this like newfound interest in carpentry and actually making a set? So you're filming this miniature, and then are you using that product to then put into post and make whatever scene you're looking to do? Is that essentially the process?
That is absolutely correct. Okay. I mean, in this particular case, we realized how far we could push the envelope of the miniature, where at the point... Very specifically, we required the pretty much a storm, an electrical storm, lightning and whatever not. So for that, obviously, we were not going to put a Tesla coil or a Faraday cage in the middle of a miniature. That was like, no, that is simply not going to happen. Besides, there's very little we're going to be able to do to control that thing. So no, the electrical discharges were definitely pushed into the visual effects world. And that makes all the sense to the world to me. And I'm not bothered by that decision. But all the reactions, or let's say all the consequences of that electrical discharge, are practical.
Yeah.
And that's where we approached, we have a great relationship with these guys from Light Panels. I love those guys. And, Curtis and Alan were amazingly nice with us. They have been with us for the longest time. I mean, I got to say that they they understand our vision. They really know where we want to push the envelopes, and they provide us the, you know, the lighting tools to make it happen. I love those guys.
Sure. So when you were in Iceland, were you using some light panel stuff as well?
Okay. Oh, completely. Yeah. I never leave home without, you know, Astras and Geminis forever. You know, I'm completely converted to those. I love their stuff.
Oh, shameless light panels plug. So thanks to Curtis and Alan over there.
I mean, also, I mean, when we were when we first met you at Phil's event, I hadn't seen the new one by ones until that event, and the effects that Phil was able to, the practical effects out of the light were fantastic. I mean, the lightning was super cool. I mean, it's just the sort of stuff that, you know, as sort of a novice in the space, I didn't know that could really even be achieved with an in light effect. Yeah. Which is really cool.
I think it goes to what Mauricio saying. You want to capture as much as you can in camera, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know up until the Phil event, excuse me, the Phil's event, that you can go program the one light, copy whatever you're programming into that with a USB stick, take it into the next light, and just really facilitate your ability to control that light and those effects so that it's incredible. I mean, you know, it's so quick, it's so efficient. It would take a crew before with traditional lights for you to try to get the lightning to happen just so, right? And in a predictable, repetitive pattern. So I think that the technology is really lending to your vision, right?
Well, it's that sort of thing as well where you were talking about, you know, in late 90s, early 2000s, where the visual effects world took over because it probably was a process to have, you know, how do you create lightning with, you know, on a set with lights that don't have that pre-programmed ability to do it. And now the equipment has caught back up to where
shutters on the old Fresnel, you'd open and close the shutters, crazy. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, of all the sectors, let's say, of the actual onset, let's say, process, I think lighting has been one of the mostly benefited from new technologies. I'm so excited with the new LED envelopes. It's just crazy. I mean, I used to have the deepest respect for gaffers and their willingness to die electrocuted. I mean, I was amazed, you know, not to mention their strength to carry those freaking Fresnels. I mean, it's crazy, you know, and how bothersome and cumbersome and hot and nicey and nasty and dangerous they were. Crazy how much better it has gone.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, this year, we've had a lot of focus on lighting. I think that we've seen a number of really interesting developments within the lighting world.
Definitely.
You know, within that industry of new people coming in, new players, new concepts of how you can light something that's light, that, you know, you don't need to be plugged in. You can have, you know, a battery pack that just, you know, slaps right on the back of your light, and all of a sudden it's, you know, portable. You can bring it wherever you want, which is really interesting.
And those are the, you know, the junctions where you realize that, you know, even if your vision is like, no, I don't want to use, you know, visual effects because it looks pretty or it looks, you know, different this way. Well, finally, we have the kind of technology that allows you to make that decision comfortably and say, like, no, you know what? I'm going to get my interactive lighting on set and it's fine and it's going to be great. And I have no hesitation on doing so. And I'm not risking anyone's, you know, integrity by doing so as well. So yeah, definitely technology does catch up in several ways. As much as, you know, dinosaurs were eventually, you know, were betterly executed, or, you know, were better execution through visual effects back then. Well, guess what? Now interactive lighting, I see no reason why not getting it on set.
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing. So, I mean, curves of technology, they'll catch up.
What else do you love lately?
What else do I love lately?
Yes.
Oh, I love bartending, man. I mean, I declare myself a highly functional alcoholic. I love mixology like crazy. On the screen, I guess. I love how democratized the whole exhibition process has become. Has gotten to. I love the fact that, you know, we have so many options of exhibition nowadays. It's great. I think that empowers the creators, the filmmakers considerably, because it used to be such a narrow, you know, such a narrow funnel.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I think that, you know, there's considerably more breadth to.
So is that like streaming?
Definitely streaming. Yeah. I would say that the streamers have really opened the envelope in order for storytellers to shine. And we already can, you know, see that, you know, obviously there's a lot of extremely exciting component, you know, content on TV now. There's very little time to watch it, but there's definitely a lot of great stuff out there where you really see stories being pushed forward, which is something that I unfortunately believe that the filmmaking industry in general has has been lacking a bit. The story has not been pushed as much as it should.
The hard thing, without the gatekeepers, sometimes the crap gets through.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes.
You only have X amount of time to watch stuff, and you don't want to fill it with stuff that's not great.
Absolutely.
The great stuff is there, but so is the junk.
Oh, completely. Completely. And that is also one of the things that I keep kind of a little bit awake at night of, is because I see a lot of similarities between the film, or the, let's say, the visual industry now, in regards to the music one.
Of course.
Where there was so much, there still is so much content out there that there's no way you can understand what's good, what's bad, what's, you know, watchable, what's listenable, or whatever not. I mean, it's just crazy how much stuff is out there that you're probably never gonna realize how magnificent it is. It's almost a little bit disturbing.
The sad thing is some of the gems don't find their way through.
I agree.
Because there's too much stuff.
I absolutely agree. And as satisfactory as it is to make the gem,
yeah
well, you know, you got to eat.
It's not a gem until it gets recognized as a gem.
Absolutely. Absolutely so. It's crazy because, you know, we always say to ourselves that we should just make things to satisfy our creative necessities, I guess, needs. But we can't live without the applause. I'm sorry. We need that. We need that understanding that the audience has resonated to our story. There is a considerable dissatisfaction in not knowing so. And,
So I wonder, I was going to ask this question a little bit earlier, but I would love to go back to it quickly.
Please.
So you went through the process of creating your vision and your friend's vision of, you know, what the world would be and how it could look. And then, you know, that was you. You had the ability to control it.
Well,
and
that was us.
That. Or exactly. You guys as a couple. So when you moved into going to, you know, trying to find distribution and find the next step of actually making it into a feature film, did you find that, you know, loss of control to a certain extent? I mean, I worked for a couple of years in development at a studio. And so a lot of the conflict that I saw every day was between the executive who had the idea of what it should be and how it would sell versus the creative who had the vision. Mm. And so as a creative, have you had to deal with that sort of back and forth, that push and pull that exists within the sort of more mainstream, you know, media place where they're actually asking you to make something, they want you to make something? And how do you sort of deal with that?
Well, you know, it's I guess all these years have definitely taught me that you have to be able to be flexible enough to make the proper compromises, always. Mm. The filmmaking process is all about basically making sure that all the pieces work in the most efficient way without no egos interfering in its efficiency. So as long as any kind of latitude is being requested that is going to improve not only the product, or let's say, or even the product within both the creative and the financial terms, I'm all up for it. And I haven't felt up to this point anyone, or not a single one of the distributors has asked us to change anything or to alter any kind of structure of the story that really deters from it in a way that it's no longer the story it's meant to be. Everybody has a particular way of seeing things, and I totally 100% respect that. Even among ourselves, when we're discussing, you know, what the story should be like, obviously there's disagreements. So as long as you're able to keep your eyes on what the essence of the story you're trying to tell is, you find so much latitude in terms of, you know, colors and flavors and whatever not. So I'll give you an example. One of the requests from one of the distributors, who's a really good friend, and, you know, he has become a really good friend and is very interested in pushing it forward, was to add a component of an entity within this wasteland, another living organism. And his way of looking at it was that if we would add that, we would get so much more exciting visuals and so much more excitement out of the situation that we were portraying. In other words, he wanted the creature. And I was, okay, look, I understand how much, you know, how much visual enjoyment comes from watching a, you know, creature. Problem is that you're not seeing the consequences of putting this creature in this environment is going to bring, you know. You can't have an isolated creature within a wasteland that's supposed to be completely void of life, because how does that creature sustain itself? What's the life cycle of these organisms that you're asking me to include? So if we're going to put that, we're going to have to carry on these additional consequences for it to be coherent. And when you start to look at things objectively, this person realized, like, okay, you know what? Yeah, you're right. We can't have a creature
there's
as
so
exciting
much thought
as
that goes
it.
Into it.
There's other ways to include some danger
absolutely
without having to.
I'll tell you what we settled for. forms shapes in the clouds. Shapes in the clouds where you really can't tell if that is that alive or is that, you know, like when we're kids, you know, you see clouds and you're like, oh, that's a dragon, you know. I mean, this kind of stuff, if you play with other components that are a little bit more mystical even or something, you are able to portray the same emotions without having to carry these kind of decisions that probably detract from your logic, you know, from your story logic.
Cool. So we were on what are your favorite things. I think we got through two of them.
Bartending and...
okay.
So I want to revisit Paul's question.
Like an Ursa Mini, maybe?
Well, yes. I'm a sucker for black magic. I don't know how many children has, you know, Grand Petty sold. Because I cannot understand for the life of me how can he get so great envelopes for such a crazily good price. It's unbelievable. I mean, I love that rant because it's so empowering with its, you know, technical capacity. But at the same time, it's so conscious that a filmmaker is not necessarily, you know, Gates or Buffett, you know. It's crazy how much is requested in terms of financial latitude from brands in order for us to accept their technical envelopes. When they don't, you know, and they don't really generally realize the kind of market that they're tackling. I really believe so. I mean, I love Alexas. For all my life, I will, you know, forever say that they're phenomenal cameras. Do I believe that getting the benefits or by, you know, let's say having the benefits that the envelope offers justifies a 10 times investment?
No.
It's hard for me to believe so, honestly, because I tell you, I grade very often Alexas to, you know, to other cameras. And whenever I get to say, like, guys, let's put that B camera on a black mic, or let's put an Ursa Mini on that one, I have such an easy time matching those things. It's ridiculous. I mean, the minimal differences are so insignificant. And I mean, 9 out of 10 guys, honestly, 9 out of 10 clients don't even know what the difference is.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy. So, I mean, again, great, beautiful cameras. They have tons of benefits. But again, in my particular view, my envelope is definitely way more, doesn't need to go that range. You know, I love Blackmagic because of that. It really enables me and empowers me as a filmmaker to do whatever I want on an affordable, you know, way. And even if I had way more financial latitude, I would still buy the same cameras. I wouldn't change, you know. Every time I show the proof of concept that we shot and whatever not, they always ask me, like, oh, what did you shoot it with? Oh, Blackmagic Ursa Minis. Seriously? I mean, why seriously? I mean, of course, you can do this on way more.
It's beautiful footage, by the way. I hope we're able to share that soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for saying that.
No,
I really
mean
it.
I mean, you know, you came in with, it was a strip of a little portion of your backdrop that you were going to use to the Phil Holland event. And I was like, you know, why does he have that? Like, what is that for, right? Then you explain it. And then you show the footage, and it's like, wow, I can't even envision doing something like that. It's like so much thought goes into it. Like, seriously,
thank
right?
Thank you.
And my first thought wasn't, you know, what was it shot on? It was just like, how'd you get the shot? But, you know, the fact that you're saying, you know, you're using this because it's just so much bang for your buck.
Yeah.
I think there'd be a lot of people that are listening to this podcast. I would agree. It's, again, it's not about the gear, right? It's, you know, how do you spend what you have to make your vision come to life?
Mm-hmm.
And so Blackmagic is your tool. And that's great.
I personally couldn't find myself more comfortable with it. I mean, every filmmaker should do their homework. I mean, they should, you know, if you're into cameras and that's your thing, check out the specs, do your homework, see what a sensor is all about. You know, really get yourself technical and understand what toy are you going to be playing with. And once you realize that, you realize what are you exactly looking for in any camera envelope. That becomes your actual wish list of like, hey, I would like it to have this and that. Because, you know, the looks that are provided by any kind of camera are always going to depend on pretty much your sensor, your glass, and whatever filters, if at all, you put in front of them. That's what's going to determine that look. So aim for that one and figure out which is the look that you like if you want to go that subjective route. Because that is all about flavors. That is all about your preference. To me, personally, the combination of size glass and Blackmagic sensors make amazingly beautiful imagery. I love that combination. But that's just my subjective flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the objective one, I see the specs and I see, like, yes, this camera has everything that I technically need, you know, to make the kind of stuff that I want to make, you know? So that's what I think, you know, any kind of camera guy should actually, you know, focus on.
So the next bullet point on the stuff you love is Zeiss glass.
I love Zeiss.
I think that's an easy one to.
Yeah. You know what? Put on the list. You know, it's yeah, I love Zeiss. I'm not gonna lie. I love Zeiss and I do like Hawks. Hawks are crazy, crazy cool. Yeah, I mean, I can geek out forever on glasses, but you know, Hawks and Zeiss definitely get me. And obviously, Cook has. It's always gonna be my you know, personal dream goal thing, you know. But that's Cook, and they know it, and they're not shy to look at me like, yeah, I'm one of these days, buddy. So they're great guys. I love them dearly. And every con we see each other again, we're like, so how's that going? Like, it's going great, and this and that, and you know, and they show us a lot of their cool stuff, and we love it, especially now that they're integrating their eye technology in such a much smarter way, with, you know, with tracking software and stuff. Oh my God, that is so exciting. That the eye technology from Cook, if I made this parenthesis, the eye technology and the LDS technology from Zeiss for their lenses is, to me, the first genuine attempt to bridge that gap between the, you know, what happens on set and what happens in post, in visual effects, a genuine effort to actually bridge that gap. And as long as we can embrace it, which it doesn't often happen, it's going to make our lives so much better. So much better. Yeah. It's pretty crazy how much more capable and how much more efficient the whole process goes if you use that technology properly. Okay, other things that I like. I really like guns. I must admit, I'm a sucker for armament. Yeah. I'm crazy about it. It's not that I enjoy violence or anything ridiculous like that. No, I just absolutely admire the amount of dedication and intellect that has been invested into armament, you know, within the envelope of humanity. It's just crazy how efficient, how good we are at it, and how crafty we are. It's just, I become fascinated by the mechanisms of guns all the time. You know?
The other things that are interesting about guns is the standards were done 150 years ago, and there's no better.
Nothing better yet. No. Yeah. Until we come out with laser blasters, I'm pretty much convinced that
high-end assault rifles and stuff, but for regular handguns.
Oh no, it's pretty much the same old. You know, the principles stand the same. Yeah, and it's just a beautifully efficient piece of machinery.
Ahead of their time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, for sure. I mean, there's something to it. The motives we can spend 14 podcasts discussing.
I can already see his next movie. Bartenders, guns, bartenders with guns. Little science fiction.
Hey, well, there's a reason why we call them shots, right?
it's beginning to sound like a Robert Rodriguez book.
Oh my God, seriously, that couldn't be better, right? He should make it, not me. You know?
Did you ever read that book, Rebel Without a Crew?
Yes, no. Of course, yes. I love the part about, you know, him donating blood. It's always, you know, puts a smile on my face. Yeah,
the whole thing. It's just phenomenal. What do I have? I have a gun. I have a guitar. That's what I'm using.
Yeah,
write the story around that.
For sure,
that's all I have.
And he's inspiring in that regard. You know, that the one thing that I will always wish Robert success for is for being so brave and so bold in just doing it.
Yeah,
doing it. Just, you know, whatever you have with whatever you get.
Didn't care. He'd do the music. Yeah. He'd do this. Yeah. He'd edit it himself.
Of course, and that's what you gotta do. Probably 90% of the times. I guess the one thing that it's hard to swallow is that even if you do all that, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to end up succeeding.
No.
It's kind of the tragicomedy between, you know, behind filmmaking.
But
if
you use it as an excuse that you don't have the right stuff, you'll never make anything.
That is absolutely right. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that statement.
Grab what you have, make something.
And just do it. Yeah.
All right, so one of the questions I'm interested in asking myself is, where can I see some of your work?
Where can you see? Well, I mean, it depends on the kind of work that you're looking for, right? I mean, because obviously, you know, there's work as a visual effects artist, there's work as a cinematographer, there's work at a... There's so many different areas where I gotten my hands dirty on.
There's bartending stuff that you can
do. Oh, guys.
We're going to go get an old-fashioned.
Well, oh, my God. If I may say, you have to try my old-fashioned. I have invested way too much liver in perfecting it, okay? So you have to do...
The liver is evil. It must be punished.
It must be. It must be put to the test. Yes. Sink or swim, you know? No, definitely. I mean, after the podcast, we should go to, you know, my bar and just like, yeah, let's just try things. No. Besides the fact, it's really all about the kind of. It's not necessarily the work that you do; it's the kind of work that really feel shows your best.
Okay.
You know,
fair enough.
I mean, I would lie if I tell like, oh yeah, everything I've done, I'm so proud of. Not true. I would say that even less, a very small percentage of what I actually have worked on, I can genuinely say, oh my God, this is something that I'm so proud that I participated on. It's just crazy that it's not that you do a half-ass job, and I don't want to portray it that way, and I don't want to save my skin here as well, but I just want to say that there's sometimes, or many times, you're going to face a circumstance where, yeah, you're not going to be contributing as much of yourself as you would wish to. But that doesn't mean that you should not do your best. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to be pretty much used to your full potential, maybe, as a creative or as a filmmaker or as whatever you want to say. Sometimes your range of your scope of work is very well defined within the project. And you have to respect that. And you have to stick to it. And you have to say, like, okay, if all I'm going to do is make this little, I don't know, fiberglass casing, that's all I'm doing. But I'm going to make it exceptionally well. And yeah, maybe you end up like, well, okay, you know, it's just a casing. Sure. But at least you can say that that casing went extremely well. You know, it looks perfect.
Have you ever seen a movie that you think back, I would have ruined that?
I would have ruined that?
Yeah. Because there's musical artists where I figure I wouldn't have made it that simple. And the simple, it's perfect the way it is. Have you ever seen a movie you feel like that?
I guess I feel there's movies I would have wished to be a part of, for sure, that I see them as flawless pieces of filmmaking, and I see myself in them, and I'm like, yeah, I would have loved to be in those, but I most probably wouldn't have been able to ever do anything as good as what they actually were able to.
Or you just would have took a different direction.
Exactly. I wouldn't have been
right
so gracious, you know? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I tend to stray away from the ratings, you know, from, you know, qualifying things on a quantitative level. I just don't see the logic to it. The more I go, the less logic I see into it, actually. I feel that, you know, it's all subjective. It's all about how you feel about certain formulas. I mean, there's, for example, I could never appreciate Blade Runner 2049 the way many people appreciate it. I just can't. Is that a terrible movie? Of course it's not. It's a phenomenal movie in many, many, many phenomenal ways, fantastic ways. Now, personally, I just can't appreciate, can't gravitate towards the places that, you know, that film wants me to go. So the same way it was for my work. I mean, the fact that I don't resonate with the kind of work that I have been a part of doesn't mean that that work is not good, you know? It's just, you know, it was a different vision than what I would have, you know, what I would have executed. So, you know, it's hard to be objective when you're so close to it, but at the same time, you have to stick to objectivity, because yeah, it's important.
So do you feel that the first piece of work that you're really proud to show is going to be this movie you're currently working on, that you feel this truly your vision come to life?
For sure. I would say that it's going to be the first one that I can say, yeah, this is actually my work. This is actually, you know, as much as I can push off an envelope of a storytelling, filmmaking envelope within my range of preferences. You know, this is the most genuine I can get, for sure. For sure. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons why I was, you know what? Stop talking about films and make your freaking own. And, you know, let the audience kill you or, you know, or cheer you. I mean, it's that's all about that one. It's, you got to do it at some point. Because then you're always going to be, I am already this, you know, disgruntled old guy always comes like, oh my God, I can't believe that they did that. And I watch a film and I can't stop analyzing and getting frustrated. Well, then make your damn bloody thing and stop complaining, you know? It's got to be that way.
So is there a website or an Instagram or something where we can see some of your work? Or?
Sure. I'm the worst one at promoting myself, right? suck at it. Sure. I mean, you can follow my Instagram if that sounds crazy, but you're just going to see this guy who enjoys, you know, doing crazy stuff. And I'll tell you what. You know what? I'll provide you guys. We are actually a film production company, Stommelhaus. My partner, actually, and my partner, top friend, Clifton Stommel, is one guy that I actually gravitated to because of cameras, actually, funny enough. Speaking of Black Magics, we're shooting this, you know, Western thing with Danny Trejo, of course. And
you know, love Danny Trejo.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Who doesn't? No, no, no. He makes great donuts.
Exactly. He does great donuts, great tacos. I mean, it's like man, Renaissance man, I tell you. So I get called to be an operator, right? And then I get to set. I start setting up my thing. And my eyes gravitate towards this great assembly of a Ursa Mini Pro, right? Of a Blackmagic camera. Like, oh my God, I go closer. Still geek out about these things. And I realize that whoever put that thing together pretty much selected 90% of the same pieces and components that I had. And like, what are the odds, you know, with the crazy amounts of, you know, possibilities that you can assemble a camera? Like this one is so similar. And I'm geeking out about it and asking myself questions. And then this 6'7" tall, you know, Viking steps in and like, yes. I'm like, whoa, sorry. I was just, you know, watching your... Yeah, you should know that definitely that height strikes a flavor in my personal perspective. So I was like, yeah, you know, I was just geeking out about it. And then we started talking and then Clifton became my best friend. It was love at first camera, I tell you. And he was obviously the first person that I told about this story that we're developing. Mm-hmm. I was like, Cliff, I want you to DP these things. You know, he's a phenomenal DP. And I just admire his, you know, his the way he looks at things. And he's also a super technically coherent guy. He gets into things. He knows what he's talking about, not because of preferences, but because of genuine knowledge.
That's amazing. Well, we'll go ahead and make sure that we share whatever links you provide us for your production company. I do want to take a chance to also thank G Technology for providing us with the G-Raid to back the podcast up and save all of our work here. So, Mauricio, muchas gracias por su tiempo.
De nada.
This is the Film Tools Podcast. And so for Avery, Paul, and myself, hope you guys tune in next week as well.
Thanks, guys.